Birth, Volume 3, The Gathering, Chapter 43. Shelley and Orphan had walked for what seemed like an hour when the lights went out. Somehow, in the dense blackness of the cavern, Orphan found one of the benches bolted into the concrete sidewalk on either side of the two-lane highway that led to Portal A, near the main entrance of Side R. It was 6.7 miles closer than walking all the way to the Camp David exit. Shelley's feet throbbed from walking so far in heels. "I'm still mortal," she thought. The concrete was too cold for bare feet anyway. They sat together for what seemed like half an hour, and Orphan took off his leather vest and put it around her shoulders. "Don't be afraid," said Orphan, putting his nose deep into her hair. "Oh, I'm not. Not anymore, I mean," said Shelley quietly. Her words echoed cleanly off the cavern walls, making it impossible to hear anything happening ahead or behind them. She never got used to the air at Side R. There was never any movement in the air. It wasn't all that different from being in a big building, but it was far bigger than any building. And anything about that. "Are you sure he's not still in L.A.?" "Ah, no. You can't be wrong about that, can you?" she asked. "I could be wrong." "It's not like you think. I'm still me. I'm still flesh and bones. It's just that I know he's coming," he said. "If I'm not supposed to know or something, that's okay. But how are you flesh and bones? You're complete, right?" asked Shelley. "I'm like I was before I came here, but I'm starting to remember more and more as time goes on. It's one of the reasons why I wanted to come back to be with you," said Orphan. "That doesn't answer my question." "Oh, damn. I'm sorry. Reporter Jeans. Oh, am I supposed to... I mean, am I allowed to say damn?" she asked as she fidgeted in the darkness. "I don't give a shit if you say damn. But at some point you have to say, what's the point?" he said. "So, you are complete," she repeated, but not as a question. "When we make love, you will know all about it," he said finally. Her cheeks burned so that she almost thought she could light their way in the dark. She could feel her heart thumping behind her breasts, moving her skin slightly against the shoulder straps of her bra that hung loosely in her seated position. She pushed her feet down to flex her calf muscles. It was a habit of shunting energy away from her face, which she knew would otherwise acknowledge the slightest emotion to the camera before millions of people. "You mean if," she said with her quietest whisper. The first distant rumbling sounded like a black freight train headed down the tunnel to pass in front of them. Shelley gripped the leather vest around her and stopped moving her feet, as though that somehow would make it stop. "Oh my God, what was that?" she asked. "Like I'm supposed to know. There's 1,000 feet of granite above us. Whatever it is, I think it's outside," said Orphan. "Oh Jesus, there's another one," she said, leaning closer to Orphan. A light dust began to fill the air from the cavern's 30-foot ceiling. Shelley coughed slightly and covered her mouth and nose with her hand. "I think the attack has started," she said. "I think they've tried enough times to kill you, don't you?" asked Orphan, wrapping his arms around her in anticipation of the approaching explosions. "I told everyone not to be afraid. I told them I loved them," she said. "I heard you," said Orphan. "I meant every word of it. No script. I'm not kidding. Those words came from me, but I really didn't think about them. They just flowed," she said. "I think you saved the world," said Orphan. "Oh, no, 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 no. I didn't save the world. Your father gave me the words, and I just said them," she said, retreating from the accolade. "Every age has a speaker. They don't write the words. They just speak them. They saved their world, too," said Orphan. The next explosion had sharp edges, like the tearing sound a lightning bolt makes when it's directly overhead. The simultaneous oozing of orange light from the high-pressure sodium lights over their cavern's entrance road backlit the new puff of dust shaken from the ceiling. The bench thumped beneath them like a roller coaster cart running over a joint in the rails. It was loud enough to drown out Shelley's scream, and the tunnel acted like a subwoofer cabinet collecting and resonating the power of its thunderous voice. She tried to inhale to scream again, but the dust was rejected by her lungs in a deep cough. Again she breathed, and again the dust was too much to inhale. Small fireworks darted across her eyelids, clamped tightly shut. She ducked her head and lifted her dress up over her nose and mouth to filter out the dust so she could breathe. She could feel the tears itching down her cheeks as they washed the dust from her skin. The orange glow was confusing, like a strange undulating fire that waved down the tunnel like a bullwhip. The road impossibly looked like a dusty gray bedsheet, snapped at one end with the ripples running away into the small end of the tunnel nearly a mile away. The explosions fell on top of one another with deafening power. Somehow the walls held up. Somehow the ceiling did not cave in. Again and again the shock waves splashed against the green granite of Raven Rock Mountain. The grass and bushes were the first to disappear as the conflagration baptized the range with superheated fire. The ancient forest was the next, as the evergreens oxidized within minutes, leaving the bare ground behind with a light covering of green crystallized silica. For what seemed like half an hour, the tunnel boomed and glowed an eerie pulsating orange. The despair of slowly being suffocated or being buried alive came up in her throat with a burning panic, but it wasn't making her strong or fast enough to run away. It was weakening her. In the power of that chaos, the will to live and the choice to die wrestled in her mind, until just at the point where she was ready to tap out, the thunderstorm striking the mountain began to pass. Softer and more muffled, the blasts sounded like they were giving up, their powerful fists convinced that they could not break this mountain. They became less frequent, and they were further away with each minute, like a dragon thrashing its mighty tail against the ground in futility. To cry that hard, that long, and not be heard, or be able to hear oneself, drains the body to the dregs of the soul. Shelley's fingers began to slide from Orphan's arm she had held onto, like her side of the park bench had dropped off into a deep canyon. He turned and caught her up in his arms and held her tightly. His strength became hers. She buried her face in his long-sleeved shirt and wrapped his vest over her head so he could not hear her sobbing. She took a deep breath, and then another. The terror began to lose its grip on her heart, and it relaxed and slowed like a rabbit that had escaped the jaws of a distracted predator. "Shelley, it's over. They finished their attack. We can keep moving now," said Orphan warmly through the leather vest over her head. She opened her eyes without moving. The air was dusty and smelled like cement. She coughed and swallowed the sticky dust that had been caught in her lungs. He drew back the vest from her hair and kissed the top of her head. He swept the hair back from her face as she looked up at him. His cheeks were dusty, but his deep brown eyes were clear and soft. She could see his sweet smile, holding her like a piece of fine art in his mind. "Hey, I can see you," she said dryly. "Yeah, the lights are not on, but the gas in the bulb seems to be glowing anyway. It might not last, so I think we should get moving." "We go that way," said Orphan, pointing over the road, so covered in fine dust that the safety yellow stripes dividing the lanes were hidden. "Well, no one'll have any trouble following our trail," she said, shaking as she stood up with him, still holding her. They shuffled at first, and then he let her walk beside him as they held hands. Shelley put her arms through the vest and pulled it tight around her. Within a few minutes she felt warmer, and the stiffness from tightening her body against the thought she would suddenly have to support the entire mountain began to subside. They moved slowly, but the glow persisted, and they could see further and further into the haze ahead as the dust imperceptibly made its way to the concrete floor. What seemed like another hour passed, and the dryness in her throat was turning sore, and she more frequently coughed it into her mouth and swallowed. "I think that's the door up ahead. Doesn't look like anyone is there," said Orphan. "My God, how are we going to open those things? They look like they weigh 10 tons apiece," she asked. "That looks like a man door over there." "Let's check it out," said Orphan as they quickened their pace. They came to a stop by a large, 4-foot-wide, solid steel door on 4 hinges. There was a 3-inch-wide steel flat bar slid across the door, locking it from the inside. There were no footprints in front of it, in the fine dust that had been falling since the attack. Orphan put his hands on the round handle for the flat bar and gripped it for a moment. "Wait! What if it's radioactive out there? What if it's on fire?" she asked. "You're right. Let's try the office here. Maybe we can see out a window or something," said Orphan. He turned the doorknob and pulled the door open. Inside, the room was bright with the light from the outside. The sill of the bulletproof window was piled with ash, and the concrete tarmac outside was charred and broken near the edges. The asphalt was melted away to the blackened dirt below. Wisps of smoke and dust were blowing in tiny dust devils across the scene of devastation. The control panel had several dials and knobs. The screens were blank and without power. He looked up, and on the glass was a thermometer reading the outside temperature at 80 degrees. He turned around and opened the gray steel cabinets behind him. On the center shelf was a bright yellow Geiger counter with a black curly cord attached to a silver tube. He pulled it out and turned the knob to battery check, and the needle came up to the green zone. He turned the knob to the 1X range, and the distinct clicking of radioactivity could be heard. "Hey, Shelley, how much radiation is bad?" asked Orphan. "Oh, like I should know. There has to be a book on it somewhere. They always have manuals in these places. Look around. Oh, my God, water. They have bottled water up here. Hand me one of those," she said, reaching for the concrete closet. They both drained a bottle and washed their hands of the dust in the bathroom of the tiny checkpoint office. "Here's something," said Orphan, holding the Geiger counter upside down. "Makes sense. On the bottom. The dial reads 0 to 100. The ranges are 1X to 1000X. Green is 0 to 100, yellow is 100 to 1000, red is 1500 to 10,000. I guess red is bad. Yellow, you need to spend less time and have some kind of breathing filter, and green is pretty much normal," said Orphan. "So what do you think it is out there?" she asked. "Well, we can't tell in here. That glass is 2 inches thick, and the walls are probably lead-lined concrete 2 feet thick," said Orphan. "What's that?" she asked, pointing to a circular plate on the steel door that led to the outside. "I'll bet this probe fits into that hole." "Smart boys. They thought of everything," said Orphan, walking over to the door. He rotated the metal plate to the side and stuck the probe through the hole a short distance and flipped to the right range to read the number of clicks per minute on the dial. "Looks like 475 or so. Is that safe?" she asked. "Let me see. It says long sleeves, hat, gloves, and mask are recommended," said Orphan. "I'm not even wearing stockings," she said. "I noticed," said Orphan, smiling. "What are we going to do once we get out of here? Look at the place. It's like Mad Max out there," she said, holding out her hand flat to the window. "It isn't like that everywhere. Let me see. There's got to be some stuff up here. Ah, here we go. Jumpsuits. Here's a small, "Put this on," said Orphan, grabbing one of the green jumpsuits with yellow stripes down the sides. "What are you going to wear?" she asked, grabbing the suit and stepping inside the small restroom. "This mask," said Orphan, holding up the paper mask. Shelley closed the door to the restroom and unzipped her dress. She hung it on the hook of the door and stepped into the jumpsuit, shrugged her shoulders into it, and zipped it up. She put her feet back into her heels and smiled. "Well, if this is a small, I'd hate to see the extra large," she said, opening the door and stepping into the room. "Nice elastic. I don't mind saying that, except for the neon yellow stripe. That would look good on the back of my Harley," said Orphan, smiling and putting his hands on either side of her waist. "Heels? On a Harley? I don't think so," she smiled back at him. "Yeah, I see what you mean. Those won't do. We might have to walk for a few days, you know," said Orphan. "What do you suggest we do?" she asked. "Well, we do have a room," said Orphan, smiling down at her. He leaned down and kissed her on her dusty lips. His hand slid under her long hair, and he could feel the heat from her neck. She let out a small sound like she had slipped into a hot bath as the coolness of his hand sent electricity through her body. It felt right. It felt wonderful. "Is this heaven?" she asked as she put her cheek next to his in the embrace. "I believe so," he said softly, holding her and rocking slightly back and forth like a porch swing. The rumbling sound came on slowly and got louder. Shelley's heart began to race in anticipation of the quaking and the bright flash, but it did not come. Still, the sound got louder and seemed to be moving in their direction. "What the hell is that? It sounds like a car," said Shelley. "It is a car, and it's inside the tunnel," said Orphan. He opened the door to the tunnel, and the sound was definitely coming from far down the end of the tunnel. It was coming fast. "Is that the... Oh, my God! It's the Purple Challenger," said Shelley, pointing. "What Purple Challenger?" asked Orphan. "That's the car that ran away from our news helicopter like we were standing still in California. That is Dick Daring's car," she said. The car rumbled to a slow stop and turned off a few feet away from them, and both doors opened. "Shelley LaSalle, you are a sight in that jumpsuit. What are you doing out here?" said Dick, walking up to her, giving her a hug and shaking Orphan's hand. "Hello, Dick," said Orphan. "You look pretty good for a dead guy," said Dick. "Yeah, like this place gets stranger by the minute," said Kyle, walking up to shake his hand and hug Shelley. Orphan smiled as he looked beyond the two young men to the car where Donna and Katie climbed out from behind the folding seats. "You guys out for a little ride?" asked Orphan. "I reckon we had the same idea as you, except we decided to drive. Quite the rock show we had a little while ago," said Kyle. "It doesn't look good out there. Take a look through the window in the office up there," said Orphan, pointing to the door. The group walked back into the check station and stood in front of the window. The twilight glow outside revealed the cinder that was once Raven Rock Mountain's forest surrounding the entrance to Side R. "Geiger counter. What reading did you get?" asked Kyle, holding up the yellow hand-held meter. 475, said Orphan. "Really? That's not too bad. We could last for 3 weeks out there. But it won't last. No fallout. Air bursts, I think. Plus, if it rains, we're golden," said Kyle, verbalizing only a part of what was going on in his head. "What do you think, buddy? We go out or go back and tell the others?" asked Dick. "That depends on the lighting situation, I think," said Katie. "Yeah, what gives with the lights? It was the pitchiest black I ever saw, and then the overhead lights started glowing," said Shelley. "Well, best I can tell is that the granite crystal that makes up this mountain was charged up like a radio battery, you know, like a crystal set radio does, and the discharge is being converted by my lens back there by the substation. It's enough electricity for a glow anyway," said Kyle. "How long do you think it will last?" asked Orphan. "Hard to tell. Those guys laid down a few gigatons of explosives, but could have charged up the whole mountain range, maybe even the whole planet. It might last 1,000 years, said Kyle. You mean those ships tried to destroy the world and instead they ended up giving us power for the next 1,000 years? Asked Dick. Could be, said Kyle. Well, that's going to piss off somebody. Free energy? Hell, we can't have any of that now, can we? Asked Donna sarcastically as she wiggled her head back and forth. Well, I say we go back and wait for things to cool off a little out there. We have a couple of years of food and water left. Why risk it? Asked Katie, rubbing her belly. We could work on the gizmo and tune it to get more power. Maybe we can get the lights to go a little brighter, said Kyle. Really? I know you can do it, said Donna, agreeing with Katie. We came out here for a reason, said Orphan. It's kind of hard to explain, but wherever he goes, I'm going with him, said Shelley. You probably want to check out some regulation combat boots to go with that very sexy jumpsuit, and I know just the girl who can hook you up, said Dick, winking at her. That car of yours still runs? Asked Shelley. Well, it ain't a stabbed rat, but she runs cool enough on alcohol. Want to do some shopping before we find out what's behind door number one? Asked Dick. You guys go. Donna and I will hang out here and see what goodies we can find. It'll be a few hours before President Riker could organize the city to move out. Besides, he needs to know it's still a little warm out there, said Kyle. BRB, dude, let's go, said Dick as he and Katie walked out to the car. The wooden salt cart from the water treatment plant seemed to make a good platform. Riker stepped up and held his hands up to quiet the crowd gathered in the street outside the row of buildings that made up the small city known as Site R, deep under Raven Rock Mountain. The glowing lights turned the town into one large nightclub atmosphere. His voice drew their attention. A few hours ago, the forces from the old Earth struck the eastern states with some kind of plasma weaponry. I don't have any damage assessments yet. We're still working on that. We have the genius of Kyle Kramer to thank for the lights we do have. That being said, we don't know if it will last, or if the power converter can be improved upon. And so, I have made the executive decision that we should gather our things and leave the confines of Site R. Intelligence tells us that the attackers will not be back, said Riker as the crowd began mumbling. He raised his hands up again and had to shout to get them to hear what he had to say. We could stay in here for a couple more years, but here's the thing. We are the people's servants. They need us out there. They need to distribute food, water, and make sure we have the basic utilities up and running as soon as possible. That is you guys. You're my cabinet and the support staff that serves society. And it's time we got out there and did our jobs. So listen up. We need everything that will roll or fly to focus on this mission. I don't have time for questions in this forum, but if you have questions, please see your supervisor after I meet with them. In the meantime, I have one action word for you. Pack, said Riker, clapping his hands together to signal he was done talking. The crowd began to disperse, and people filed back into the various buildings to get their things together. Just as he hopped down from the wooden salt trailer, the purple Challenger rumbled through the opening from the main road and rolled smoothly up to him. As soon as the lights turned off and the motor stopped, the two doors opened, and Dick and Katie got out with Shelley and Orphan climbing out of the back seat. Agent Smith and Hadid, as well as Lorraine, joined Riker, as they all started talking at once. It has begun, said Hadid. You are a sight for sore eyes, said Smith, shaking Orphan's hand. Is this what I think it is? Asked Lorraine. Well, I don't know what you call it, but everyone is out there. The light ones, I mean. They're just waiting, said Orphan. Waiting for what? Asked Lorraine. Their mates, the souls. I guess they form in pairs, or pairs of pairs. Anyway, they wait for the other half, said Orphan. Oh, my God, I'm your other half? I knew that. I mean, I knew it the first time I saw you, but, started Shelley. Oh, yes, yes. You see, mortal birth is not always synchronized with the souls. They might have been created at the same time, but they aren't born at the same time. Plus, they have to find one another once they grow up, which doesn't always happen, said Lorraine, glancing quickly at Riker. Yeah, what she said. There's also no sense of time on that side, and it's difficult to stay focused on getting back. You really have to stay focused, said Orphan. I have a feeling time is going to take on a different meaning for all of us, said Riker. Hey, I just wanted to say a couple things before this gets too churchy. We've been to the main entrance at Gate A. It's wasted out there, and my little brother says it's a little too hot for exposed skin right now. How about another day or two before we venture out without the right gear, which is why we came back? Right now, we gotta see a certain girl about some boots, said Dick, pointing at Shelley's black heels. Wait, you guys are going out? Asked Smith. Orphan got the same vibe we did. Something live is going on out there, and you gotta be present to win, said Dick. I think my father's on his way here, said Orphan. Oh, son, I'm afraid if he was anywhere within 20 miles of here, began Riker as he shook his head slowly. I know he is coming. Don't ask me how I know, but I know, said Orphan. Are you the first? Asked Hadid finally. No, sir. There are many. This is just the morning, said Orphan. Hadid held up his right hand as though he was about to sing a few notes of something. The group went silent. And it shall come to pass that on the morning of the third day they came out of the earth and rejoiced. And there was a new heaven and a new earth, recited Hadid, as though he was reading it from some ancient record in his mind. That's it. A new heaven. Excuse us while we pick out some boots for this lady, said Dick, as the four of them turned together and headed for Building A with a slow step together. Sorry it took me so long to get up here. I was going the wrong way on a one-way road, it seemed, said Bet as she walked up beside Ancient Smith. She put her hand on his shoulder and smiled at his face, but she knew he was in agent mode. No public displays of affection, he would say. How do you feel about a little walking? Asked Smith, turning to her with a smile hidden behind his training. How little? Asked Bet. I'm not sure. Maybe back to Washington, said Smith. No problem. I thought you might be talking about Pasadena, chuckled Bet. The people are going to need us. My sources tell me we are on our own for a few hundred more years. I really didn't know what that meant until I saw Orphan, said Riker. What do we do for now? Asked Lorraine. Like I said, pack. Agent Smith, can you see what equipment will run? Is there anything that will fly? Asked Riker. I'll find out, Mr. President. Hadid, you stay with him. I'll find Jones and see if we can round up the motor pool guys. Did he say Kyle was out there at Gate A? Asked Smith. Hadid nodded in return. Right. Mr. President, we'll meet in Building E lobby and make assignments in, say, 3 hours, said Smith. Perfect. See you then, said Riker.